Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And now we continue our October series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. This is our contribution to the People's Guide to Power series. Our news team has begun in conjunction with this year's elections in New York and New Jersey. What unbalanced power relationships contribute to making housing so unaffordable in greater New York decade after decade, even as every New York mayor announces historic affordable housing programs and every New Jersey governor comes with a plan to get property taxes under control. And yes, that's true of county executives in New York State, too. So we're doing segments on these things throughout the month of October here on The Brian Lehrer Show, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. During this first stretch of the series, we're going back in time for some of the roots of today's unaffordability crisis. Last week in our New York City segments, we went as far back as the LaGuardia administration during the Great Depression, with the advent of public housing projects, and even back to 1916 when New York enacted the first modern zoning ordinance. Today, we'll start moving closer to the present with two New York City housing officials who served during the Dinkins, Giuliani, and Bloomberg eras. Deborah Wright was a member of the New York City Planning Commission and the New York City Housing Authority Board under Mayor Dinkins, and Commissioner of the Housing Preservation and Development Department under Mayor Giuliani. She has since gone on to be CEO of Carver Bancorp and now on the boards of Citigroup and Time Warner. Geraldine Perrine served after Deborah Wright under Giuliani as Housing Preservation and Development Commissioner and continued in that role for Mayor Bloomberg's first years. She is currently the Executive Director of the Citizens Housing and Planning Council, a housing policy think tank. Ms. Wright and Ms. Perrine, thanks so much for coming on to help us understand history and to look forward to. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian.
Deborah Wright, can you hear me? Do we have Deborah Wright on the line?
Yes, thank you, Brian.
There you go. Now we got you. And Ms. Wright, can you take us back to the early 1990s? Did the city have an affordable housing crisis like we do today?
Yes. I mean, I don't know that there's ever been an era when New York City hasn't been perceived to have a housing crisis, because it's a gateway city where people view a lot of opportunity and want to be here. I think Geraldine will remember as well, though, that what we had then, which we don't have now, is an abundance of vacant buildings and vacant land. And that was its own set of, created its own difficulties for the neighborhoods, and it was a crisis because those were lawless buildings, and you were living in any proximity to them, you were calling the mayor's office about that as opposed to affordable housing. So I think that the real crux of the benefit we had of thousands of buildings that were unfortunately managed by the city of New York, we had a way to expand units in hundreds of neighborhoods across the city. That's just the success of that means that we don't have that, that access anymore.
Right, and that is a piece of history. In fact, Mayor Dinkins himself will be on later in the week, and we'll talk more about it with him. But when the Dinkins administration took office in 1990, Mayor Ed Koch's 10-year affordable housing plan was still in full swing, based largely, as you say, on the city rehabilitating buildings that were abandoned by private sector landlords during the 1970s. So then you stayed on to work for Mayor Giuliani. Giuliani and Dinkins were ideologically so different on so many things. How much did that extend to affordable housing?
Well, a lot of it, it takes a long time to change direction when you're moving hundreds of millions of dollars through a pipeline. I think the thing we focused on was making sure that the programs were open to for-profit local property owners and managers, as well as developers instead of just nonprofit developers, and trying to accelerate the pipeline out of the city, and more importantly, not to take more buildings in because small landlords were having tax problems. So we spent a lot of time trying to keep those guys current and out of trouble so we wouldn't take more buildings in. And then trying to get the private sector involved in taking some of the small buildings out and hiring local people to be supers et cetera. Of course, we still had some larger lots that produced much more units, but we spent a lot of time on the local neighborhood buildings that were, you call it 10, 20 units as opposed to hundreds or thousands of units.
Before we bring in Ms. Perrine, you mentioned opening it up more to for-profit developers. Mm-hmm. What did the for-profit developers bring? I noticed in the mayoral campaign of Sal Albanese in the Democratic primary this year, he brought up that issue. He wanted to restrict for-profit developers and put affordable housing development back primarily in the hands of the private sector. De Blasio was not doing that. But what did you feel that they brought to listeners who might think, oh, why bring in for-profit developers? They're just going to, work to take money out, not put money into the public interest.
Well, ultimately it comes down to what the taxpayers want to fund. At the end of the day, most housing in New York City and in every place in the world is built by and managed by for-profit entities because they have the money to do it, to hire people and to keep investing in buildings. And ultimately, if that is being funded by taxpayers, people run out of money compared to other more important uses like safety, health, schools. And so that's the tension. There's only so much money that taxpayers are willing, and in my view, should be willing mm-hmm. to fund relative to the private sector.
So, Ms. Perrine, picking up on a similar point, the old cliche is that being mayor isn't like being in Congress because there's no Democratic or Republican way to pick up the garbage.
Right.
I think LaGuardia might have said that. Was there a Democratic or Republican way to approach the affordable housing shortage as, Giuliani came in and you worked for Giuliani as compared to Dinkins?
I'm not sure that it's really about a political party. I mean, I think every mayor comes in with their own philosophy, with their own, certainly, personality, with the way that they like to operate and the things that they set a priority for. And if you're a longtime government employee like I was there for 28 years. So I started in city government in 1978. When Ed Koch first came in on a wave of kind of reforming city government and bringing in fiscal responsibility. So, each administration, each mayor kind of sets a tone. And if you work inside an agency, you try to look at what are the real priorities that need to get done, how to listen to what the new administration wants to get done, and how to try to shape that into programs that are really going to be successful and kind of solve problems on the ground. Ironically, I think you're sort of seeing some of this getting played at a federal level now, right, where you see federal employees, playing a role that I think they had been invisible for a long time, and now they're being revealed in a different way. And I think that happens in city government, too. And so every mayor kind of opens up the door for also an opportunity to kind of raise some issues mm-hmm. that maybe weren't priorities before.
Right. So my memory of the Giuliani years is that what was in the news about housing was battles over his policies toward the homeless, but not much on the broader issue of mass affordable housing preservation or construction. Was there an essential Giuliani approach to affordable housing? Or maybe that's what we just heard from Deborah Wright.
I think there was, again, an opening of a door. And I think, Deborah, who came in as the first commissioner, really sort of faced, in a way, the hardest challenge because she had to translate the ideas that the candidate had into practical policies. What she focused on, and she's, kind of under representing, I think, her great success, was to actually change the infrastructure around how we took tax foreclosed properties. Because while it was important to try to move the remaining inventory out into good owners' hands, it was equally important to change what happened when a building didn't pay their real estate taxes. And what had happened between 1978 and the time that Debbie walked in the door was that essentially those buildings moved into a central management system, which was very important in the 70s and 80s in order to save those buildings from bad and unscrupulous landlords. But that situation had dramatically changed by the mid-90s. And so, you know, Deborah really pioneered this idea that we need to not just move buildings out, we have to rethink how they come in. And that new legislative process called the third-party transfer system is still in place today. So I think creating that kind of institutionalized change that is right for a new era doesn't mean the old one was wrong. It was the right thing for that time. But then we needed some new solutions and some new tools, and they're still working.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC in our series, A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. We're talking for most of this week about some relatively recent history after we did some older history last week of affordable housing policy in New York today with two of Mayor Giuliani's housing officials, Deborah Wright and Geraldine Perrine. Tomorrow we'll talk to Deputy Mayor from the Bloomberg era, Dan Doktoroff, who was very involved in development. And on Friday we'll talk to Mayor David Dinkins himself. And let's take a phone call right now. Roy in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Roy.
Good morning, Brian, and good morning to your guests. I've been working with the city for a long time, and throughout my years during the Giuliani and Bloomberg era, both administrations took it upon themselves to sell off the majority of the city housing stock, and that basically went to private developers. I don't know if it was due to favors, but the majority of the city housing stock was basically sold off, and that basically took away the ability for the city to house the homeless, homeless families, and people that were looking for affordable housing. I'll take my my answer off the air. Thank you, Brian.
All right. Thank you for your call. Who's more relevant to that? Deborah Wright, go ahead.
That's a very easy answer because there's, public record of all. You know, at the end of the day, we concluded that there were buildings that the city just could not manage well. And Geraldine referenced that. These are multifamily buildings where there was no scale. We had hundreds of young people coming out of college, going into the city for their first job, who had never been trained to be property managers. And so it was not a good system, and our focus was to get the buildings into professional hands. And Geraldine will also confirm that we reached out to communities where small real estate firms had been wanting to help the city take care and manage those units, and we got those buildings out to them, local hands, also local employees. So we spent quite some time doing this in a thoughtful way, and I think it was a very successful effort.
Did either of you see gentrification as a problem in your day in government? It seems like we went from too many neighborhoods being run down at the start of your era, as you were both describing before, to too many neighborhoods being gentrified out of affordability today. Geraldine, was gentrification an issue back then?
You know, I think it was starting to be something that that people were thinking about. But I think, again, you know, and Deborah's probably better suited to talk about this when she came in, you know, Harlem didn't have a bank branch, didn't have an ATM. I live in the West 80s, and I can remember meeting C. Virginia Fields in my dry cleaner because there was no dry cleaner near her.
The Manhattan Borough President
who
lived in Harlem.
Yes.
How about a grocery store?
Right, exactly.
So, Ms. Wright, can you fight blight and gentrification at the same time, or is it a zero-sum game?
You know, I think it is a great question, and it is very hard to do. And one of the core reasons, Brian, is you can't put a face on or a number on the thousands of people who have been in these neighborhoods for generations. And so we focus so much, who got in at zero, right? And so they're sitting on a lot of wealth now, and I can't tell you how many of their grown kids come to me to say, you know, what do we do with this? You know, I'm sitting in an apartment building across that was a gas station site at 110th and Central Park North, where I can look out at two buildings where I personally sold apartments for $50,000 a piece. So I know that there are a lot of people in there who are sitting on a tremendous gain because they took a risk to come through to a very scary neighborhood at that time. And so the people across the street from them have paid millions of dollars to live across the street from someone who's in at $50,000. And there just aren't a lot of cities where that dynamic took place. So I certainly agree that it's a complicated situation, but I think in the whole, we created a tremendous amount of opportunity for people of all ranges of income. And if the impact means that wealthier people decide to come and diversify the neighborhood, So, my attitude is that's a good thing.
Yeah, and I think also there were some things that we did now more when I was commissioner sort of at the end of the Giuliani administration that I think carried over into the Bloomberg administration, which was to try to take on some of these very large sites that we knew were really going to have a big impact in a community. So unlike just, you know, you do a building here or there. So we had sites like the Rheingold Brewery site, which was 7 acres in Bushwick, the Schaefer Brewery site, which was the first residential rezoning on the Williamsburg waterfront, which we did 40% subsidized and 60% market rate. The Rheingold site in Bushwick, it was very important to the community organization on the ground there that we provide a range of housing, both home ownership and low-income rental, but that the prices remained affordable for the people there. And it took a fair amount of work, and it took a lot of sort of direct community engagement to kind of tackle a big site like that. Arvern was another example that we spent 2 years with a consulting firm who just worked on the ground with the neighborhood. So I think sometimes there are some things around gentrification, like just we're a desirable place and people want to be here who have a lot of money. But there are ways, I think, to engage locally, particularly when you have a large enough site that you can really impact it, I think, in a positive way. I'm not sure. I think in retrospect, if I look back really at a very fairly long time working in housing, I think maybe we did underestimate, and this isn't about the Giuliani administration, this is sort of just looking back from 2017, the power and the oversized influence of some of the money that comes into these communities.
Like who? And that was the last question that I wanted to ask anyway before we run out of time, because the framing of this series is A People's Guide to Power, Real Estate Edition. So I wonder who you see with all your years of experience in the field at the time and hindsight, who does have too much power in a way that makes it harder to create enough affordable housing for the people of New York?
I guess I'm not associating those two things together. I'm just saying that when neighborhoods begin to change in a disproportionate way to really make people feel like not necessarily physically being displaced, but this is no longer my community. This community is not speaking to me. I think sometimes that's a reaction to sort of what happens on the ground in the marketplace when a lot of people with a lot of cash move in and retail starts to be changed and their neighborhood character starts to feel different than it used to. And in some ways, this is an old story. This is what cities are about. I don't think there's a boogeyman here. And God knows, I mean, I spent 28 years in government and then 11 years running a not-for-profit, so I'm not sure my insights into power are all that, you know, useful. But I think there isn't a villain in the piece. Mm-hmm. I think it's really about maybe thinking through how to absorb change and direct it in a way that's going to help to both expand the housing stock, also preserve the stock we have, but make room for growth. And those things are not simple, and they don't all work seamlessly.
But Ms. Wright, on the same question, it often feels like developers have the city over a barrel. They threaten not to build anything unless they can build mostly market rate. So the best any mayor can get is 25, 30, maybe sometimes 40% affordable, and that's only when the developers seek a zoning change for height. Other developers can build whatever they want, all market rate if they choose. Do they have the city over a barrel, and is there anything we can do about that?
Capitalism is imperfect. I think that's just the reality. And developers and the city government, state and federal government have been negotiating since the beginning of time. And I think we've actually done a pretty good job in this city of balancing the merits. And you see towers all over the city where our city, our mayors and our governors have negotiated to have affordable housing within the same building that multimillionaires live. I don't think you see that in cities across the world and even cities in this country. So I know we all want more, and this is a gateway city where people want to be. I personally think getting public housing straight, fully occupied and safe, and taking those vacant properties associated with public housing and building them out is one of the biggest opportunities we still have left. I think we've been great at negotiating parts of large developments that are market rate for lower income people. But at the end of the day, there will be an end, right? The city is very heavily built. It's a very popular place to be. And it's expensive. And so I think we have fought as a city. We've fought fair, sometimes not fair, but I think we've delivered a very good result. I hope we'll keep the bigger picture in mind as we all fight through these tough issues.
Two guests who each served for a time as commissioner of the Housing Preservation and Development Department under Mayor Giuliani, Deborah Wright and Geralyn Perrine. Thank you both so much for coming on
today.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
And we continue this series tomorrow with Mayor Bloomberg's Deputy Mayor for Development, Dan Doktoroff, and then on Friday with former Mayor David Dinkins.